I want to thank Barrage Coffee for sponsoring this podcast. It's veteran owned and operated by Kyle Early and his crew. I want to thank them very much for sponsoring us. I'm honored and privileged to have my next guest on. I'm blown away, actually. It's been nearly 20 years ago, and next month will mark 20 years, September 11, 2001. We all can kind of recall where we were that day, but my next guest lived what we were watching on TV, and what a tragic day. I want to welcome to the show Tim Brown.
Hey, Alan.
Man, I remember I was in the military, and it was all unfolding, watching it on a little TV in the motor pool. I can't imagine what it was like actually being there and living that horrific day. For the listeners out there, can you give a brief intro of your background and what you're all about? And, you know, there's an organization that you that you're with, and it's a great organization. We'll talk about it later in the podcast, but I want to kind of give the listeners your background and what your story is all about, man.
Cool. I grew up in Connecticut. I was not a good kid when I was early teens, and I met a friend of mine, Jay Walsh, told me I could be a junior fireman when I was 15 years old, and my eyes lit up, and I said, there's such a thing as a junior fireman. And that kind of got me back on the straight path. And, ever since then, I've wanted to be I wanted to be a firefighter. And of course the ultimate place to be a firefighter is New York City. So, you know, I went through that whole process and got, appointed to the New York City Fire Department in 84. I went to the South Bronx, Hunts Point, if you're familiar with it, and in the 80s and early 90s, it was not a very nice place. So a real strong dose of reality working there. And I spent most of my career in the Bronx. I went into special operations around 1991, and I worked there till 98. Where I went into the mayor's office of emergency management. So I wasn't really a practicing firefighter anymore. I was more wearing a tie and representing Mayor Giuliani at the scene of emergencies and disasters and things like that. So that's where I was on the morning of September 11th, 2001. Our office was 7 World Trade Center, directly across the street from the North Tower, which was 1 World Trade Center. And I was a supervisor in the field operations. There was about 15 of us, and our job was to go to the scene of the emergency and not be the incident commander, but assist the incident commander with things kind of outside of his direct purview. So for the fire chief, I would help him with our utility companies and other things where he needed support. Every morning I went in early, and I had tea, because I don't dig coffee. Sorry, Barrage. I had my tea and my Cheerios, and I was sitting there reading the newspaper, because back then we didn't have smartphones or anything. And the power went out in the building, which was very unusual for a modern high-rise building. And 5 seconds later, the power came back on, and I realized we were on backup power. And I realized something pretty big had happened. But I didn't hear or see anything. And the people who were sitting at the window looking, facing the North Tower, all at once stood up and ran toward me screaming. They ran toward the exit, and they were running by me. And I grabbed one young lady by the shoulders, and I had to kind of shake her back to reality. And I said, what happened? And she said, a plane hit the tower. And that was the first time that I realized, that it was game time for us. We drilled and practiced for all kinds of different disasters and emergencies. And, I think everybody kind of thought initially that it was some errant plane. A guy had a heart attack. It was a small, private plane. I don't think very many people thought it was a large passenger jet. So that's what I thought. So I went up to our offices on the 23rd floor. I ensured that our listening post, we call it Watch Command, was doing a full activation, which is about, they have to make about 150 phone calls. Mike Lee, the supervisor there, gave me the thumbs up, and they were already buried in communications, which was their expertise. So Mike had that under control. I went to our emergency operations center. Mike Berkowitz, the supervisor there, was powering up our Star Wars-like EOC. He gave me the thumbs up. And I grabbed my two other radios, my police and fire radio, and I put my third radio, my OEM radio, in my hand, and I went down to my car on VC Street. I changed out of my dress shirt and tie, and I put on, we call it a raid jacket. It said mayor's office on it and on the back, and heavy leather boots. And they made us wear these stupid green helmets so people would know who we were. Mm-hmm. And we're trained as firefighters to see try to look at three sides of a building before you go into the building. And I wanted to do that before I went into the North Tower. In order to do that, I had to run up an exterior staircase, concrete staircase, from the street level to the plaza level. The plaza was in between the whole World Trade Center complex, between the two towers. And I ran up those stairs so I could try and get a look at three sides of the tower. And those stairs are famous now because they've become known as the survivor staircase in the 9/11 museum. But initially, in the beginning, I ran up toward the building. Thousands of people subsequently ran down those stairs to escape and to live. And they are now, that staircase is now in the museum. When I looked out over the plaza, it was strewn with debris, on fire, black smoke. And if you remember in the video, all the paper fluttering down from the upper floors. And that's exactly what it looked like. And I started to maybe realize that it was not quite a small plane. Although I had no idea of the magnitude that was to come. It was difficult to size up the building because the 80 to 90 stories where the plane went in was 80 stories up. So it was very hard for me to look up and get a decent size up of what was going on. And I went into the North Tower there at that plaza level, and I had to go down again to the lobby in the street level. So I had to go down one level, and there was an escalator right when I went in the doors, and there were hundreds of office workers trying to get on that escalator to go down one level, to go down another level, to go underground and get out. That's the way they were being directed by the Port Authority police and the people who worked, the security people that worked there. So it was hundreds of people like in a funnel, and you would expect these people to be panicking and pushing and shoving and trampling each other. In fact, they were doing the opposite of that. And it really struck me that for every person who was injured, obese, pregnant, disabled, there were four or five civilian office workers. And this was not cops and firemen. These were regular humans, because it was more than Americans. But they were doing what humans do, what good humans do. They were helping each other. And I said in that moment in my head, I said, we're going to survive this and we're going to be okay, because that's the true spirit of humanity. I got into that crowd, I went down the escalator, and as the lobby of the North Tower revealed itself to me, I could see hundreds of firefighters awaiting their orders to go up. And the firefighters were dressed in their turnout gear, so with the yellow reflective stripes on their coats, and there were hundreds of them awaiting their orders. And I chuckled in my head a little bit, because I understood why the cops called us bumblebees, because when we get together, it looks like a hive. Mm-hmm. And I actually had in the middle of this disaster, I had a little chuckle because, you know, because the cops teased us. You know, we teased them, they teased us. And it just made me laugh a little bit. And I got to the bottom of that escalator, and right in front of me was a bumblebee standing like right in front of me. And it was my friend, Chris Blackwell, firefighter Chris Blackwell from Rescue 3, where I used to work in the Bronx, special operations. And not only did I work with Chris for 7 years, but we worked on the same shift. So we did just about everything together, death-defying stuff, funny stuff, like eating dinner together, sleeping in the bunk room together. He was like a blood brother to me. Chris was also, in his time off, a paramedic in Connecticut where he lived. So all Chris did with his life was help other people.
That's amazing.
He dedicated his life to other people. And we knew that whenever we had a badly injured patient, whether it was a burn victim or someone trapped in a car, or especially a child, we always tried to put that child in Chris's hands, because we knew that that patient, that child, had the best shot at life in his hands. That was the legend of firefighter Chris Blackwell. And Chris and I came face to face, and we always greeted each other the same way, no matter what. We were the Bronx guys. We didn't shave. We didn't wear the tie. We didn't clean our faces. We were always smudged with smoke and snot and stuff. And, our helmets were all burned up from all the fires, and our turnout gear was burned up. And so we were the Bronx guys.
Some badasses.
Well, a lot of experience, you know, like the Brooklyn guys back then. You know, they, Rescue 2 had tremendous experience also. But we weren't the Manhattan guys, right? We weren't, the tie was all the way up and the clean shaven. But Chris and I always greeted each other the same way. We would come face to face, close to each other, and we would stand up and come to attention. He always had the unlit stub of a cigar in his mouth. And he'd reach up, take the cigar out of his mouth, and we'd lean in and kiss on the lips and come back to attention, and he put the cigar back in his mouth. And we did that because we loved each other like blood brothers. But we also did it to freak out all the other firemen, which we thoroughly enjoyed doing. We thought it was pretty funny. But it was a true expression of love between us. And we did that in the lobby of the North Tower pretty early on. And Chris said to me, "Timmy, this is really bad." And I said, "I know, Chris. Be careful. I love you." And he said, "I love you too." And he turned around and he went in the stairwell. And I want to emphasize this. He said it to me, Alan. He said it to me. For Chris Blackwell to say this is really bad is saying something. He knew. He knew, and he still turned around and went in that stairwell and went up those stairs to try to save the lives of people he did not know. And that is the oath firefighters, police officers, EMT, paramedics, military, intelligence community, that's the oath we take at the beginning of our careers, right? And eventually, we may be called to fulfill that oath. And this was the day for firefighter Chris Blackwell to fulfill his oath. And he faced it with courage and strength and bravery, courage of steel. He did it. He turned around, he went in the stairwell, and he went up. And American hero Chris Blackwell did not come back down those stairs. Mm. He kept climbing up. No, someone yelled. Go ahead, Alan. Sorry.
No, and that's it, man. That's insane. Yeah. True bravery.
Someone yelled my name, and you can actually hear it on the French filmmakers, the Naudet brothers tape. You can hear him yell it, and he yells, "Timmy!" And I turned and I looked across the top of the hive of the bumblebees, and I could see my best friend, Captain Terry Hatton, across the top, because he was 6'4". And I could see he was yelling for me to come to him. And I ran to my best friend. Terry was the captain of Rescue One, the Manhattan Special Operations guy, right? So he's clean shaven. His tie is all buttoned up. He's got his clean turnout gear and his clean helmet. And Terry was the captain of Rescue One for a reason. They were grooming him to be the chief of the New York City Fire Department one day, because he was that good. Not only was he a fireman for years and years in Rescue 2 in Brooklyn, he had tremendous experience and he was highly respected. He had been awarded many medals, but he was also really smart, and that was really hard to find. And the big chiefs in the New York Fire Department knew that Terry was the future, and they were trying to groom him and mentor him. And they gave him this coveted spot as the captain of Rescue One to give him more Manhattan experience. I got to my best friend, Terry, and he put his arms out and he grabbed me and he pulled me into his chest. And, you know, he was 4 or 5 inches taller than me, a big guy. And he had the Halligan in one hand, he had his light in the other hand, and he squeezed me to his chest, and he kissed me right here on the cheek, and he said in my ear, "I love you, brother. I may never see you again." Mm. I said back to him, you know, I kind of laughed it off, because we had done so many dangerous things together in our career when we worked together. We had been through horrific fires, things we never should have survived. Fires where our legs are going through the floor and the fire's coming up from underneath and we're getting burned. And we did all that stuff together. We climbed through the rubble of collapsed buildings together. We were on the pile of the collapsed building in the Oklahoma City bombing within 24 hours. We did that together. So I was, I guess, accustomed to daring death and always coming back. So I laughed it off, but remember, Terry's the smarter one here. He was always 7-8 steps ahead in his mind. "I love you, brother. I may never see you again." A kiss on the cheek. And then he turned around, he grabbed his men, and he went in the stairwell, and he went up, just like Chris. He said it to me, Alan. He knew it. His men knew it. He's actually on the video footage of the Naudet brothers going into the stairwell, and that's the last image we have of Terry and his men. A fireman comes running into the lobby of the North Tower, and he's yelling, "Another plane hit the South Tower," which is the first I knew of it. We huddled together, the leadership huddled together, and decided how we were going to split our forces. And it was decided that myself and Assistant Chief Donald Burns from the fire department would go to the South Tower and open that command post. I got together with Chief Burns. We started running toward the South Tower, and we had a quick conversation. I said, "Chief, what do you need me to do?" He said, "We're under attack. We're at war," which I think everyone knew. This is really dangerous. Do your best and be careful. And he said, I've ordered a fifth alarm for the South Tower, which is another 350 firefighters. But the first 350 are going to the North Tower. It's going to take a while for our fifth alarm to get here, so we're on our own. And Chief Burns was this, another like legend in the fire department, maybe possibly the most respected chief in the fire department because he had 41 years as a New York City firefighter. And he looked like it, right? His, in the dictionary, Irish fire chief would be his mug as the example because he had the red rosy cheeks. He had the lines of experience and knowledge forever etched into his face. And he spoke with a thicker kind of borough accent than most of the guys. Timmy, do your best and be careful. Yes, sir, Chief. A woman came running over to us yelling that there were people trapped in the elevator. Chief gave me the nod, go. So Chief went to the command post. I followed this woman and she took me to the elevator banks in the South Tower lobby. And she took me to one specific elevator. And the hoistway doors were open so you could see into the shaft. But this elevator car had not come down all the way. So just at the top of the opening, you could see, I don't know, maybe 4 inches or so. You could see into the elevator car. You could see all the people's feet, all the people who were trapped in this car, and they were screaming. And I remember seeing the men's jacket and shirt sleeve as they were trying to pull the car down more to get enough room so they could slide out. There wasn't enough room. But the elevator car was not moving. I didn't know it. I only learned this later. But that elevator car free fell 70 floors because when the jet crashed into the South Tower, it snapped the cable. So these people had just taken this horrific 70-story free fall, clearly thinking that they would be killed when it impacted. But the elevator worked the way it was supposed to, and the emergency brakes clamped onto it and saved the lives of those people. But now those emergency brakes are grabbed onto that car, and you're not moving it. It's not going anywhere. So they were trapped in this car, and very sadly and tragically, the elevator pit below them was full of jet fuel that was on fire. And they were right above this, so they were also getting burned. And these people were in dire trouble. What they needed was a fireman, like a real fireman, not me. You know, a fireman that had his gear on and tools and equipment and all those things. In my desperation, I turned to my right to just see if I could see something to help. And when I turned to my right, my shoulder hit a person and I looked over and it was a bumblebee. And I looked up at his face and it was firefighter Michael Lynch from Ladder 4, who was my friend, who I had worked with in Times Square and just for a year when he was a brand new fireman. And he was very highly respected. In fact, he was being groomed to become a special operations firefighter, which I knew. Michael put his hand on my shoulder and squeezed my shoulder and said, Timmy, I got it. 3 words, I got it. 3 words that between firefighters who knew each other meant he had the training, the experience, the tools and equipment, because he brought us a whole fire truck full of tools with him, and the intestinal fortitude to save the lives of those people. He was the person they needed. I'll come back to this scene in a little bit, but over our radio, urgent, 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 confirmed by the FBI, third plane incoming, impact imminent. Urgent, 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 get in the stairwells, take cover. I said, Mike, I gotta go, you got this. I ran to the command post, I found a landline that worked, and I dialed 0 for operator, and she picked up. And I said, I'm with Mayor Giuliani in the World Trade Center. I need to speak with the White House immediately. She tried to get me through and she couldn't get through. I said, then I need to talk to the Pentagon. And she said, the Pentagon's under attack. And it's the first we knew of it. I talked to New York State Emergency Management and they assured me that the fighter jets were coming as fast as they could to protect us overhead. We would be unable to do our job if planes kept crashing into us. So we needed the military. Maybe for the first time in modern New York City history, we were begging for help from the United States military. Because we, an army of, I don't even know, 10,000 or, well, 10,000 firefighters, but 20,000 cops. Even our army needed help from the military. The lobby was filling up with people who were badly injured. Imagine, Alan, you're injured and you're coming down the stairwell, a dark, smoky, wet stairwell. And you're coming down around and around and around and around 70 times, 70, 80 floors. And you finally make it to the door that says lobby on it. And you open the door and it's bright and it's dry. And you see firefighters and police officers and you're injured. You're like, what do you say? You're like, I made it. Right? And you're done. You collapse. There were people collapsed, injured all over the lobby. Mm. The problem was the firefighters were going by them and cops were going by them and going up because that was our first priority. So the place was filling up. It was impeding our egress, the evacuation of the tower. And so Chief Burns told me to go get the paramedics and bring them into the lobby so the paramedics could start treating these people and getting them out of the lobby. And that's the reason I left the South Tower lobby. I went out onto Liberty Street. So this is on the south side of the South Tower, which was the second building to be hit. When I went out onto Liberty Street, I immediately saw to my left, and it's burned into my visual memory forever, a dead fireman in the street who was crushed by a woman who had jumped from the upper floors. Mm. It had happened 2 seconds or 5 seconds before I walked out. In fact, his buddies who were running to go come into the tower were tugging at the two bodies, which are now one, because they thought they could still save him. And the desperation in their faces, I'll never forget.
Wow.
Someone yelled my name, and I looked over, and it was firefighter Mike Lynch. And he was at his truck, ladder 4. And he was trying to take the hydraulic motor off his truck so he could use the, we call them the spreaders, which we use in car accidents. But that motor is very heavy. It's a two-person operation. And so he had yelled for me to come help him. And so I started running toward Michael, and another firefighter got there first. And Mike waved to me, and I waved back to him. And that's the last time I saw my friend Mike. I turned and went to West Street. I found the paramedics. I told them we need to go into the South Tower lobby. They got all their stuff together, piled it on their stretcher. Myself, Captain Charlie Wells from EMS, and two other paramedics, so there were 4 of us, went running with the stretcher to go back into the South Tower. In order not to get crushed, we were running right along the south wall of the 3 World Trade Center, which was the Marriott Hotel, which adjoined the South Tower. And in that lobby, the doors we were running by were a restaurant in the lobby of the Marriott called the Tall Ships Restaurant. So we run by these doors, and the cell tower was set back on the sidewalk a bit. So we kind of turned the corner and we were about 20 or so feet from the door of the south tower to go back in when it collapsed.
So you were under a ledge, so people jumped or debris or?
No. I mean, everything was coming down. This is before the collapse, right?
Okay.
But bodies were crashing down parts of the building before the collapse. And, you know, we were just running and hoping kind of tempting fate a little bit, but we had a job to do. We had an oath to fulfill. And I'm a faithful man. If he chooses, it's my time, then it's my time. But while I'm here on earth, I'm going to do good. And I'm going to do what's commanded in the Bible is to love your neighbor, right? And help your neighbor. And that's all of us. I'm not a braggart guy, but that's just what we do. It's just what we do. So we come around the corner. We're about 20 feet from the door of the South Tower when it begins to collapse. And the first indication was snapping steel, and not small steel, large steel snapping. And that crack was so loud that it reverberated through the canyons of Lower Manhattan. And for, you know, whatever it was, we all understood as soon as that happened that the building was collapsing. It was just too loud for that not to be what it was. We're trained as firefighters. You can never outrun a building collapse. It happens too fast. You have to get cover overhead. So the first thing that came to my mind was getting back into the adjoining building, the Marriott Hotel. And I yelled to the paramedics, follow me. And we ran over to the hotel and went into the restaurant, the Tall Ships restaurant. And it was as clear as your room is, as clear as could be. And in an instant like that, it went pitch black. And everything that wasn't nailed down was in my face. I hit the ground, now crawling, and the wind picked up tremendously. The noise, I compare it to sitting on the tarmac at JFK, surrounded by 747s with the engines full blast, and you're in the middle of it. I don't know how else to describe how loud it was. The dust was so thick that it was clogging your ears, your nose, your eyes, your mouth. I'm trying to breathe. I'm trying to stick my mouth in my shirt. I'm trying to crawl. I'm trying to live. And I know from our experience that the strongest part of a collapsing building is a vertical column, because we had found people alive in building collapses next to vertical columns because they're the strongest part. And that's what I wanted to do in my mind. And I was just crawling and trying to breathe and trying not to get crushed. And I found a big steel vertical column. I think I was led to it because I think that God didn't want to take me just yet. That's looking back on it. I wrapped my arms around this big column and I held on for dear life. My helmet blew off my head. I have a 110-story building collapsing on a 50-story building collapsing on me. My legs go up in the air. The air, as the Marriott Hotel collapses, all that air is getting pushed out where I am. I'm trying to hold on to this column. I have no idea how I was able to hold on to the column. The only explanation is that it was not my time. In the end, it was scientifically proven that that wind was 180 miles an hour that was trying to blow me out into the street. I have no idea how I could hold on to a column in 180 mile an hour wind. But I did, and as fast as it started, it stopped. it was less than 30 seconds, the whole thing. And I was alive, which made me very happy. I'm not afraid of dying, but I didn't want to go now, you know. I wanted to be able to hold my family and tell them I love them one more time. And now I maybe had a chance to do that. I tried to go back out. I was crawling, and I tried to go back out onto Liberty Street. But now the building was collapsed. So doors weren't doors. Walls weren't walls. It was just piles and piles of steel. And I remember running into a truck with the motor running. And I don't know why, but we didn't know what was coming at us, and we were under attack. So all I could think of was truck bomb. And so I turned around and go the other way, back deeper into the Marriott, and I came to a roll-down gate, a metal roll-down gate that separated the restaurant from the lobby of the hotel when the restaurant was closed. And in the collapse, it had come down. So I reached under to lift the gate up. And when I lifted it up a couple of inches, all these fingers came from the other side. And together we lifted the gate up. And there were about a dozen people on the other side of this gate, firefighters and civilians, who they were rescuing when the collapse occurred. Okay. And the collapse had gone through right behind them. So they were like on a ledge between the steel roll down gate and the collapse, which was right behind them, which was seven stories down. And I wanted to keep going that way. And they said, there is no that way. It's gone. It was a major collapse. And so we turned around and we went the other way. And we kind of formed the chain and we went through the rubble. And it's beautiful, clear. The pilots call it severe, clear day as it was. No humidity, no pollution. It just clear as a bell. But where we were on this beautiful blue sky morning was pitch black under the thick dust and smoke. And through that dust and smoke, we saw a firefighter coming toward us with a big, bright flashlight. And he was yelling to us, come this way, come this way. So we went that way, and we were able to get out of this rubble and live. All I could think of then was to get to the Hudson River and jump in and swim to New Jersey, which is something I don't recommend anyone ever do. luckily, you'll die. I mean, if you're not an experienced swimmer, the current is too much. It's a bad idea to even try that. It's far. It's I don't know. Gotcha. A couple miles, but that's, you know, in my craziness in that moment, that's what I was thinking. I thought that was a better choice than staying where I was, right? Mm-hmm. Just like those people in the upper floors of the towers chose to jump out the window rather than burn to death. So I wind up running north. The second collapse occurs, and I didn't get really hit with too much debris, but that cloud of small debris and dust went over me, and I knew that lots and lots of my friends were just killed. But I still wanted to survive, and I kept running north till I met up with Mayor Giuliani. So I want to go back to the scene of the elevator and firefighter Michael Lynch. Shortly after that terrible day, there were some rumors in the media that were made up, not true, and very hurtful. where they said firefighters, instead of rescuing people, were stealing jeans from the structure store. This all came from the fact that when they pulled ladder four out of the crater, it was smashed down so deep, several stories underground from the collapse, that it got squashed together, and there were all these jeans from the structure store in it. So some idiot journalist wrote about it, and it was ladder four, which is where Mike was from. And I said to myself, I cannot let Mike's widow, Denise, think this. She has to hear from me about her hero husband. So I jumped in my undercover police car and I roared out to Long Island, and I sat on her couch in her living room, and I told her the story of her heroic husband and how what he was doing in the last moments of his life. And I said, one day when they find his body, they're going to find it with the spreaders and the people in that elevator. Mark my word, that's where he was. I saw him. I was with him. That's what he was doing. And I told her in that moment when firefighter Michael Lynch from Ladder 4 said, Timmy, I got it. He may as well have had wings coming out of his back, because he was the angel sent to save the lives of those people. In the end, we can prove that Michael saved two women out of that elevator. We think three, but we've heard positive confirmation from two. Three women talk about being saved out of that elevator by the guy with the red four on his helmet, which was Mike. So again, Mike stayed there despite being told that there was a third plane coming in to take cover. Mike stayed there with those poor people until his very last breath, and he was getting them out. And then he's killed. Mm. I want to just do some numbers quick. On September 11, 2001, 2,977 innocent human beings were murdered by radical Islamic terrorists. All true, factually true. I did not say 2,977 Americans, because they weren't all Americans. In fact, one of the beautiful things about America, and one of the beautiful things about New York especially, is that we're a melting pot. It was 2,977 people from 90 countries. So these terrorists attacked the world. They attacked humanity itself. They attacked good humans, innocent humans. Go back to the escalator scene where the people are helping each other. Those are people from 90 countries who helped each other. Right? That's the true spirit of humanity. That is the goodness in 99% of humanity. In 90%, I don't know. And that's how we overcome these evil people. Out of that 2,977, 658 innocent human beings from one firm, Cantor Fitzgerald, on the top floors of the North Tower. 658. And you know, that just like rolls off someone's tongue, right? It's unbelievable when you think about that number.
It's huge.
When the first plane hit the North Tower, it took out all the elevators and all the stairwells. Those people were trapped in an elevator or in an island in the sky with no way down. So whether they were killed on immediate impact or were forced to make the choice to jump or were at a window trying to get fresh air, sticking your head out the window, and there's 50 people behind you trying to get to that window, and what happens? Everybody's pushing, and you get pushed out the window. That's the choice, or not a choice, that people had to make. There are also recordings from the 911 system of people laying on the floor as the smoke gets thicker and hotter, and the floor gets hotter. And you listen to them on the recordings, losing consciousness and suffering a slow, hot, smoke, painful death. And I only say that because it's the truth. In the South Tower, 18 people above the point of impact live. And we think that is due to one civilian hero named Wells Crowther, better known as the man in the red bandana, a 24-year-old young man who took it upon himself to find a passable stairwell and then to stay there, not to run down to save his own life, but to stay there and yell, "If you can hear my voice, come to my voice. I have a stairwell." And then he ran up and down, carrying people, injured, burned people down. And then he'd run back up and get another one. He'd run back down again and give them to someone. Then he'd run back up again. Wells Crowther put the red bandana on his face. And he was later identified by some of the 18 people as the guy who saved their lives. He was a volunteer fireman. He had some training. He wanted one day to be a New York City fireman. But in this capacity in the South Tower, he was just a civilian. He didn't have to stay there. But you know what, Alan? He took the oath as a volunteer fireman. And he lived the last moments of his life fulfilling that oath as a volunteer fireman. There are stories like this throughout both towers of civilians risking and then giving their own lives to save others. Moving forward now, 20 years later, the Tunnel to Towers Foundation, whose motto is "Let us do good," continues to live and give in that spirit, the goodness of humanity. The CEO and 9/11 family member, Frank Siller, right now is walking from the World Trade Center. He's walking from the Pentagon to Shanksville, Pennsylvania, to the World Trade Center. It's going to take him around 35 days. It's over 525 miles. Frank is 68 years old. He's doing it to honor his brother, to honor the police officers, firefighters, and military who protect and serve for us so that we can go to bed at night in peace, in safety, and security. That's what the Tunnel to Towers Foundation does. Frank is doing the walk to raise awareness of the Tunnel to Towers Foundation. So you can go to t2t.org and you can follow Frank on his journey. It is one of the greatest charitable organizations I've ever been a part of. I volunteer with them. And I walked with, I carried the American flag along with two other guys, and we walked with Frank the first 12 miles in Washington, D.C. to set him off. There's a book called What Brothers Do by Michael Everett Brown. What Brothers Do by Michael Everett Brown, which was written by the brother of American hero Captain Patrick Brown from the New York City Fire Department, murdered on September 11th. And his brother, Dr. Michael Everett Brown, wrote a book about what it was like for us in the days, weeks, and months afterwards. It tells a very brutally honest journey of how we suffered and how we got through it. Sadly, Dr. Brown, who wrote the book, passed away in October from 9/11 illness, from digging through the rubble to find his brother. But this book lives on forever. Doc Brown's wish in his will, and to me personally, was that this book, all the proceeds from this book, go to the Tunnel to Towers Foundation. So it's the book for him was a labor of love, and it's all good. All proceeds go to a great, great charity, the Tunnel to Towers Foundation. So that's it. I will answer questions. We can have a chat.
Yeah. In the description, I'll put them in there. And that way people can click the link. They can go to the Tunnels to Tower, which I have. It's amazing. I've actually talked to a marketing guy from there. It is one of the best organizations I have personally on the website seen and talked to this guy about. I was actually trying to get involved with it as well. I'll also post a link to the book. Can you get it on Amazon?
Yeah, I think Amazon sends. Yes, you can get it on Amazon, and you can get it on the Tunnel to Towers website.
I got a couple questions, man. And I know we ain't got a lot of time, but one thing, like you said, you didn't know about the planes. Were those buildings pretty soundproof that you couldn't even hear the explosion, you know, when the planes impacted? Because it seemed like, or is there just so much chaos going on that you couldn't even really hear it?
I think it's the latter. I think if you were paying attention more, you probably would have heard at least some of it. But, you know, I think it's 18-acre site too. So it's you know, the buildings look like they're next to each other, but they're kind of far apart, you know. So, you know, we were in the lobby. It was very loud where we were. Radios, people yelling, you know, so just absolute chaos. And so, you know, I mean, you know, maybe some of the other chiefs and things in the lobby heard it, but I didn't hear it, you know.
It's crazy. Yeah, I remember watching it on, like I said, on that little portable TV, and I couldn't comprehend it. I was not even 21 years old yet. I was 20, and I'm in the military, and I'm like, oh, here we go. You know, because nobody knew it was a terrorist attack at that point, obviously, you know. Right, and then the second one, and then you hear about the Pentagon. It's like, yep, we're doing this. Another thing is, in them towers, I personally have never been in them, and people that haven't, when you talk about the staircase, are they wide staircases, or are they pretty narrow?
Unfortunately, back then they were narrower. There was only room for one group to go down the stairs and the firefighters and police officers to come up the stairs. So it was single file up and down. And that's one of the changes that's occurred in New York City, is the staircases have to be more fire and smoke proof and wider. In fact, in the new buildings downtown in the World Trade Center complex, they actually built into the new buildings a firefighter only stairwell so that we can go up with all our equipment.
I got a buddy. He's from New York. His name's Marty. He watches every episode I have on, and I always give him a shout out. But he had a firefighter friend that he worked out in the gym. He was 24 years old. His name was Mike Kiefer. He wanted me to ask if you knew him.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't know him back then, but I know of his family now. Okay. And I certainly know his name. His family's participated in a lot of the same stuff I've been doing. So yeah, I know who he is.
Okay. Another thing I wanted to ask you, how are you holding up? I know it's coming up on the 20-year anniversary. I know on that day, it's probably a world of emotions that go through you. How are you holding up today? And, you know, I don't care what you do in life. If you experience a traumatic event, it's going to give you PTSD. I have it myself from my combat tour. And how are you holding up? Because that was the worst thing that you could go through, honestly.
Yeah, I mean, I did therapy for years afterwards, and it was very effective for me. It taught me how to compartmentalize grief and things like that. I found that it's just my thing. Andrea Bocelli's voice brings me peace, so I can disappear into his music and listen to his voice, and it helps me very much. But I draw my strength from God, and as long as I am here, it's very clear to me what my mission is. I have tremendous purpose. I'm not lost at all. I have goals. I have purpose. I have his strength. And, you know, after the 20th anniversary, a lot of this is going to go away. And I'm sure that there's going to be some emptiness for us, for the families, and all that. But I'm still on a mission, and I just think I'll have that for the rest of my life. We said on every car, every firefighter's car in New York, was the bumper sticker "Never forget," right? And I live that mantra: never forget. I will always speak of the heroes of that day, my friends, and how they fulfilled the oath they took as young firefighters, police officers, EMT paramedics, the young military in a global war on terror, right? Over 7,000. You know, Alan, over 7,000 of them went to war because of me. Because of us, voluntarily, they didn't know who I was, but they stepped up and they took that oath to serve justice for me. They lost limbs. They committed suicide. They have bad PTS because they went to do that for me and for my community. That's why Tunnel to Towers is so important for us, for our community, because you guys went and did that for us, wearing on your uniform FDNY patches, NYPD patches, Port Authority Police patches. You did that for us and continue to do that for us. So the best thing we can do is what the Tunnel to Towers Foundation is doing, is to try and give back to those who survived but are struggling by paying off mortgages, building smart homes. There's no end to the need. The list of catastrophically injured military is 1,000 long. And we owe it to every one of them to take care of them. Take care of the Gold Star families. Take care of the line of duty deaths families from police and fire. It's our responsibility. So that's what drives me. That's what overwhelms and overcomes my PTS, I guess.
Got you. No, it's amazing. I got one last thing for you, and it's a picture. Yep. It says 1,000 things for me, and I just want to know what this picture means to you. Because it about brings tears to my eyes looking at it, and I'll be honest with you.
That photo was taken years ago. You can see I actually don't have much gray hair there. But it's after the memorial first opened. And I am going to the panels. This is the North Tower footprint. And I'm going to the panels looking at the names, with the Freedom Tower being rebuilt in the background with the American flag hanging on it, with the American flags in the names in the panel. And I'm just reflecting and reminiscing about all the innocent people. And I'm reading their names and I'm remembering them, especially the ones I knew, which is somewhere over 100 people, mostly from FDNY Special Operations. But I also knew Dick Morgan, who was the emergency management guy for Con Edison. I knew many of the cops, the NYPD cops from their elite emergency service unit, because we had traveled to Oklahoma City together after the 95 bombing. So I'm honoring, I'm paying respects, I'm remembering my friends. And that, I guess, was kind of the beginning of my lifelong career, kind of so far, of speaking their names, remembering who they are, remembering what good they did in life, and remembering and reminding people how they died, who did it, and why they did it. Because that's all a part of the truth. It's all a part of never forget. These were just innocent humans who just went to work or were passing by.
You know, I never got to see the World Trade Centers in person. I went in 2008 when those were being constructed, and then I went back when they were completed. And I'm not a cry. I'm not a guy that cries. I try to be mentally tough for my family, just my background in the military. I try to be tough. When I walked up on there, I could not control the tears that were rolling out of my eyes. There's actually a picture. I didn't know at the time who took why. My ex at the time took that picture, but I literally had to put my sunglasses on because I was just so much emotion went through me. So when I saw that picture of you, it made me think of so many things that were running through my mind. I can only imagine, and I wasn't there, what was rolling through your eyes looking at that. And oh boy,
I saw things that no human should ever see. I saw humans do to other humans what should never, ever happen. I've seen evil up close. And it's very, very, very bad. Yeah. But we have to overcome it with goodness, and we have to overcome it with strength. And sometimes we have to overcome evil with a taste of their own medicine. And that's what they understand. So justice is still being done. We still have to protect America, or something like this will happen again. We have to be vigilant, and we have to prevent evil from visiting our shores again. So thank you, Alan, for your service from the bottom of my heart. And if you do come to New York, you come see me. Absolutely. And I'll take you down there.
Yeah, I want to thank you from the bottom of my heart, honest to God, for coming on and sharing your story. I know it's not easy to talk about.
Yes, sir.
I'm truly honored to have you on. And you know, when I hit you up, you right away you said, "Yeah, absolutely." And I'm, like I said, I'm honored to have you on, man. And I wish you the best of luck. You know, if you need somebody to talk to on September 11th, shoot me a text and I'll be thinking about you, man. Honestly.
All right, brother. Thank you for everything. And we'll stay in touch. All right.
Absolutely. Thank you.
God bless you, Alan. Thank you.